way back when, Christians decided to come in out of the cold, and they were then faced with the problem of how do you keep water, rain, sleet, snow, and ice out, and how do you bring water and heat in and not destroy the place? And as we learned this winter, that is not an easy task. There are practical problems of how you create space for the family of faith, and there are also theological problems. And Christians have been discussing and debating and talking and praying and thinking about this for a long time. And that's why we were so pleased several years ago when Ralph and Roberta Cook determined to establish this lectureship in memory of Ralph's father, Elmer. Ralph and Roberta are here. I would like them to stand so that you can greet them. It is good to have you with us, and for you as well as us to celebrate the reality of this dream, namely the possibility of coming together on a regular basis, at least once a year, to talk about architecture from the standpoint of the faith community. It's now my pleasure to introduce John Payne, our professor of church history, who will introduce the speakers. John.
I am pleased to introduce the program for this occasion of the celebration of the 100th anniversary of the building of this beautiful structure. The seminary trustees laid the plans for the building in 1892 and made the final decision concerning its design and erection in late January 1893. They awarded the contract on May 19, 1893 to John Evans, who submitted the lowest bid of $29,340, not including, however, the heating or the brownstone used in connection with the brickwork. The Hummelstown Brownstone Company furnished the brownstone at a price of $9,545. The contract required the completion of the building by May 1st, 1894. As it turned out, they were 9 days late. Terrible. Tonight, we are privileged to have two speakers to comment on the significance of this edifice, now known as the Lark Building. Mr. Robert Yeager will discuss the architectural roots of the building in his lecture entitled A Sacred Trust, the Public Role of Religious Buildings. The Reverend Rochelle Stackhouse will treat the liturgical aspects of the design of this chapel, known as Santee Chapel, though previously it was known as Santee Prayer Hall. The chapel was extensively remodeled and received its present design in 1925 on the 100th anniversary of the founding of the seminary in another place called Carlisle. Ms. Stackhouse's discussion will no doubt deal with a bit of seminary history which preceded the erection of this building by 50 years, namely the Mercersburg theology, which emerged when the seminary was located at Mercersburg, Pennsylvania, from 1837 to 1871, for this theology affected the design of this chapel. And though I am tempted to comment on that, I am resisting and not wanting to steal any of Shelley's thunder. Mr. Yeager was educated at the University of Michigan, where he took his MBA degree, and at Cornell University, where he received his master's degree in historic preservation planning. After working for several years with IBM Corporation, Mr. Yeager moved into the field of historic preservation. He took a position with Philadelphia Historic Preservation Corporation in 1984 and eventually was named as this organization's Senior Vice President for Religious Properties Programs. Since 1989, he has been co-director of Partners for Sacred Places, an organization he helped to found. Its purpose is to promote the preservation and sound stewardship of religious properties. He has also been editor of Inspired, a national bi-monthly magazine. Ms. Dackhouse is a graduate of Millersville University with a BA degree and a Princeton Theological Seminary with a BD degree, and she is currently a PhD candidate in liturgical studies at Drew University. She has been a pastor of United Church of Christ congregations in Michigan and New York. Since 1991, she has served as adjunct professor of worship here at Lancaster Theological Seminary. In 1992 to 93, she did double duty, also as dean of the chapel. She has just received a call to a UCC church of the congregational variety just south of Boston. And we shall miss her when she leaves us. We are pleased to have you both as our speakers for this Cook Lectureship on the 100th anniversary of this building. The format will be for each of the speakers to make a presentation in turn and then for them to engage in a little dialogue with one another, and then finally for us all to have an opportunity to join in with comments or questions.
Good evening. I would like to add my thanks to Dr. Payne for his gracious introduction and say how delightful it is for me to have come from Philadelphia tonight to join you. I should make a confession, I suppose, that I've learned a lot as I've done my research and reading to prepare for tonight. I've done some thinking about my own ethnic background and heritage. So here's my confession. There's a bit of the Swedish in me, and a bit of the Czech, and a bit of the German, a lot of German actually, and a bit of the Dutch. And so when I look at my grandparents and my parents, I see denominationally that they have been Roman Catholic, and they have been Lutheran, and Congregationalist, and dabbled a little bit in Christian Science. And yet somehow through all that, my parents ended up Presbyterian. So I guess I'm a kind of a denominational mongrel. And I confess that freely, and I'm rather proudly actually, because in a way it does combine different traditions and strains. And I think that's one of the themes we're discussing tonight. And so indeed, when I began reading about this space, which came out of a German Reformed tradition, which had respect for and drew in the strains from the Roman Catholic Church, and of course now, which is a part of the United Church of Christ, it all seemed to make sense from my own standpoint in terms of where I've come and where the church has come this last 100 years and more. I should say another word about what I do, because you might wonder why I'm here. Partners for Sacred Places is the only national nonprofit entity that is concerned with helping congregations and religious institutions care for older properties. And one of our purposes is to encourage the church to celebrate its architectural heritage, which is, I think, one of the things we're doing today, to celebrate and to understand it better. And also, I think, to appreciate all the influences that came to bear on buildings that we all come to love today. But I think our other purpose is to encourage the good stewardship of religious properties, taking good care of what we've been given. And if there's ever a space like this that clearly shows that its owner has been a good steward, this is it. Good stewardship has been practiced here clearly for many, many, many years. And it's a privilege and an honor for me to be a part of this celebration tonight, because this is what we stand for and this is what we're about. And if you have more questions about the kind of work I do, please do feel free to kind of collar me after we're done tonight. Now, to kind of tie in with what Shelley has said so very well, let me begin by quoting a scholar who has written about the birth and wide influence of what has become the Lancaster Theological Seminary by summing up the point of view of its founders. Quote, The history of the church must be understood as an organic development, as biological growth, in which each new stage of history grows out of and fulfills the preceding stage. And what does this mean? It means that the church in every era must be considered the legitimate bearer of the Christian faith and life. It means that those Christians who presume to repudiate any stage of church history thereby cut themselves off from the stream of organic church life which relates them to the church's founder, which again reflects and echoes what you've heard just now. Now, this impulse to combine the new and the old, respecting and combining the different strains of church tradition to create something newly powerful and compelling, this impulse can also be said to have driven the genius of the man behind the design of the Lark Building here and where we sit now. So this impulse to combine the new and the old, respecting and combining different strains of tradition to create something newly powerful and compelling can also be said about the man whose designs inspire the architect of this building. That's a very important thought, and that's why I think when I was doing this research and preparing for tonight, I was increasingly excited. Furthermore, the additions and refinements of this chapel space, which you've just heard about, again reflects and illustrates this important ecumenical principle, you might call it, an ecumenical principle. And indeed, the appreciative and Catholic small c approach espoused by the founders of the seminary and the developers of the seminary can be said to represent the philosophy of the historic preservation movement. Because preservationists, and I have been trained as a preservationist, increasingly have come to appreciate the various influences and additions and accretions and layers that older buildings come to develop and add to themselves over time, and appreciate all the layers. And as time goes on, we don't want to willy-nilly tear away the layers. We want to appreciate them and see that they may each have value. And so it's wonderfully appropriate, I think, that the Lancaster Seminary has chosen over the years to practice this good stewardship of this building for future generations to use and to enjoy. Now, what I'm going to do is begin by talking about the Lark Building as a whole, its origins and its significance, and I think I have some slides that you'll enjoy. So we're going to set up the slide projector screen now, if I could ask for your help now. And we'll take the lights down, and I think you'll enjoy this part of it. And then I will add a few more words about the development of the chapel and then make some conclusions before Shelley and I kind of retire to the table to have a conversation. Now, if you had meandered down the streets of Pittsburgh or Boston or St. Paul or Detroit or any of dozens of other rapidly growing industrial cities and small towns in America in 1888 or 1890 or 1892, you would have seen a remarkable phenomenon. Nothing less than an architectural craze, a fad, had erupted across the American landscape. And the result was dozens and scores and hundreds and thousands of buildings that, as we'll talk about in a moment, were uniquely American, were monumental, powerful, impressive, and it seems built to last forever. Institutional buildings most often, city halls, courthouses, markets like the one that you have here in Lancaster, for example, and of course, churches and religious institutions. Built in every color of the rainbow, usually masonry, meaning stone or brick, but sometimes orange or brown, such as this church in Detroit, with lots of wonderful stone decorative elements of other colors, or sometimes limestone white, such as this church in Ithaca, New York, or sometimes even green, such as this Serpentine Chapel near Philadelphia. So, what was happening? How did it all start? Well, first you have to start with what had been the Romanesque revival in America, which really arrived rather late. You don't find much of it in America until the 1840s and 1850s. In fact, often this church here on Rittenhouse Square in Philadelphia, which is Holy Trinity Episcopal Church, is often given credit as being the first major example of a Romanesque revival church in America, designed by John Notman. Wonderful landmark, built of brownstone. And it is fairly true to the original Romanesque style of medieval Europe. And the details are fine, and the decoration is it spreads over most of the building, and it's a very different animal from what would be developing in the 1870s and 80s, thanks to a man named Henry Hobson Richardson. Now, Richardson created what was called at the time the modern Romanesque style. You might call it the American Romanesque style. And his beginning point was the Romanesque he saw in books, and the Romanesque style revived in buildings such as Holy Trinity Church. And over the course of about 15 or 20 years, he struggled and felt his way to his own style, his own unique way of expressing the Romanesque. And this is an excellent example of the kind of building that begins to tell you what he is developing in the 1870s. This is Brattle Square Baptist Church in Boston, sometimes called the Church of the Holy Bean Blowers, because at the very top of the tower, there are angels with long trumpets that stick out, and it looks like they're blowing beans. I suppose I shouldn't say anything so irreverent, but I couldn't resist. This building still stands, and there are remnants of other styles, the Victorian Gothic, the polychromatic styles, the many-color styles of buildings that were being built in the 1860s and 70s. I won't go into details, but you're beginning to see the use of masonry, the heavy stone, the heavy round arches, the prominent tower, and I'll tell you more in a moment. But this is an early example of what he was doing in the 1870s. Not that much different from, but a growing difference from what was being done by other architects of the period. Another example is the Cheney Building in Hartford, Connecticut. The multicolored voussoirs, those pieces of stone over each arch, would have been practiced by or used by another architect. But the way he's using stone, the way he's grouping these windows, and the increasingly heavy, low, massive, strong arches, which is perhaps the most singular quality of his architecture, is increasingly obvious. We're still in the 1870s, but his first great masterpiece was being designed at this time. Trinity Episcopal Church on Copley Square in Boston. Still considered by architects across the country as probably one of the dozen most important landmark buildings this country has ever seen. It's a remarkable thing. And I think architectural historians who look at his work and see this great place are convinced that this really is the first new style invented and developed and perfected in America. And therefore, since Richardson had a connection indirectly to this building, it's very important that we take a look at this for a moment. So, Trinity Church in Boston. Another view. What are we beginning to see here in its more perfected form? The heavy, heavy, strong, square tower at the center, plus a number of towers at the corners. Heavy rock-faced masonry, rock-faced meaning naturally cut. It's not finished to a smooth, flat finish, but it's allowed to look like it's like on the side of a cliff. And heavy blocks of stone. At this point, he's using polychromy still, that is, the different colors of stone. You see the main body of the church is a light color stone, and the contrast is all brown stone or a brown sandstone. He's grouping windows in groups of two or three or four, and always the round arch. As with other buildings of the period, typically these churches and other institutional buildings are picturesque. They have irregular profiles. They're not the kind of regular, white, symmetrical building we would see 30 years later. And here you can see it contrasted to a modern building next to it, a whole world of difference. Ah, in the interior. One of the interesting things about Trinity Church, which again has something to say about this building, is that this was built for an Episcopal parish, where you would expect in the 1870s or 80s to find a Gothic space with long, narrow nave and side aisles and transepts and dark. And this instead is high and open and wide. With wide, there really is no long nave at all. It's really a Greek cross that is with square arms, with no long nave. But why is this? It was built for Phillips Brooks. And that's the answer. One of the greatest preachers this country's ever seen. By the way, he had been a rector at Holy Trinity Church in Philadelphia before he went to Boston. Attracted an enormous congregation, all of whom wanted to hear and see him. So the long, narrow nave, where people at the back could not possibly hear and see the preacher very well, was impossible. And Phillips Brooks demanded a different kind of building. And so, in effect, Richardson was forced to combine ancient tradition with new demands. And indeed, this Trinity Church served as a kind of precedent for worship spaces throughout the nation for preachers that were attracting audiences not of 300 to 500, but often in the thousands. So if one were to sum up Richardson, I think you would say his genius was in combining the romantic, the picturesque, where things were designed for emotional effect, because they were sublime, because they were powerful, because they had an impact on the viewer. They often had symbolic meaning, picturesque, irregular profile, rich colors. And of course, this is one of the other stunning things about this interior, is the rich colors in the stained glass and in the painted surfaces. And yet they were also rational. They were planned to be functional, with purpose and reason behind each room and connections between rooms that encouraged flow and connection that made rational sense, which reflected Richardson's time with the École des Beaux-Arts in Paris, one of the first American architects to ever spend time in Paris. And let me show you actually the building type that really is most relevant to the Lark Building. And that was Richardson's library. He built a number of them. This one here is a detail from the Billings Library in Burlington, Vermont. And here is the arch in its most solid, massive, low, imposing form. This is now dating from the 1880s, a good 10 years after Trinity Church was begun in Boston. The tower remains, but overall, the buildings he was designing in the 1880s were increasingly simplified and streamlined and rationalized. And there are some libraries he did that are reduced to their actual elemental forms, reduced to the least possible form that he could imagine. And so, some architectural historians make the claim that Richardson was the first in the line of architects that led to modern architecture as we know it today. And that's a whole separate lecture, and we don't have time for it. But if you know names, Richardson is said to have led to Louis Sullivan's work, who in turn led to Frank Lloyd Wright, who in turn was really one of the first, if not the first, truly modern architect. And so I think it's a matter of pride and importance that Richardson, with this enormous importance and with this long-term influence on American architecture, was the primary inspiration for Lark Building here that we're in now. Now, in particular, this building, and I think it will strike the precedent for the Lark Building, and it also reflects the rational planning side of Richardson. Now, it's still irregular. It still is asymmetrical. It still has a prominent tower and then little turrets attached here and there. But its three main functions are evident from the exterior. Its purpose, its function, is expressed on the exterior. And buildings built before and even buildings built afterwards did not always make that attempt. And the three parts are the central hall and reading room, which is at the center where the tower is attached. The far side is the library stacks where most of the books were stored. And in the foreground is a kind of apsidal form for an area that was for a special collection of books, the Marsh collection of books. But in some cases, this kind of wing for Richardson's libraries would serve as provide space for a collection of paintings or artworks. So the function of storage, the function of entry and reading, and the function of an art collection or a special collection of books were each expressed with a separate part in the building. All of it increasingly reduced and simplified to its basic element, and very different from the fussy, elaborate buildings that would have been built 10 or 20 years before. And actually, by lesser architects, were being built even then. Now, that leads us to where we are today. Now, one could ask, well, indeed, you know, Richardson's architecture was all the thing to build, say, between 1888 and 1893 or 1894, but does that alone explain why it's been used here? Now, we might be reminded that this seminary had had 70 years of a kind of nomadic existence, as you've heard, and in fact, 20 years had been spent waiting and hoping and praying for this building to finally be built. And so I think it makes sense that the Richardsonian style would have been used to say once and for all that this seminary was here to stay. It was established, it was solid, it established a new identity, it was modern, and yet it was also traditional because it reached back to the medieval style that's associated with the ancient monasteries and churches of Europe. So it makes perfect sense. The design was by John C. Smith of Harrisburg, about which not much is known, although perhaps one of you here may have more to add, but I found little. And the work was completed in 1894, as you've heard, at a minuscule cost by today's standards. But although Smith was the architect by name, I think you can say that Richardson was its inspiration. And we'll look again to see how the three parts of this building reflect and echo the three parts of the library you've just seen. But first, a word about Smith. He did bring some landmark qualities to this building that helped to make it so special. Its siting, as you've just seen, looking across the lawn adjacent to the Franklin and Marshall campus. It expresses very fine workmanship and highly effective use of massing, including this incredible tower with attached turrets to one side attached to the prayer hall, which became the chapel. And you can see the gargoyles and the voussoirs and the other decorative details, but all that is sublimated. It's less important than the overall massing, which follows Richardson's principles. And a word about the materials. These are some of the finest materials available at the time. It's a pressed common brick, but more important, a word has been said about the brownstone. It came from Hummelstown, near Harrisburg. I have done some reading on this stone. It was probably the finest brownstone that could be had at the time. And it's a beautiful, if you look at it carefully, it's a beautiful purplish brown hue. And it is very fine and very durable. And if you're a preservationist and take a look at buildings carefully, and you may know already just from your common experience that brownstone buildings often do not fare well over time, and you'll see the flaking and the spalling of the stone. This stuff is good stuff and will last a very long time, and it was a very good choice and was probably more expensive than another source would have been. So what are those three parts? Well, of course, we have the main mass of the building with its classrooms and offices, which is analogous to the entrance and the reading room that you would have found in the Billings Library. At the center of the building, of course, looking through these wonderful gates here, it's a wonderful vista. You have the original library wing, which, by the way, was fireproof and closed. And I read this, that iron doors, self-closing iron doors, were originally fitted on this building to make sure that the building was closed and not open to the air. And then, of course, the building to the right is the modern addition, which greatly expanded the library's capacity later. I won't say much about that now. Although I suspect I appreciate your sentiments here. And here is the wing where the prayer hall was located originally, which is now where we sit today. And I think if there's any piece of the building that helps one appreciate the severity and simplicity and strength and massiveness of the style and how beautifully Smith handled it, it's in this part of the building. We can see the high Hummelstown brownstone foundation and the brick walls rising above and the simple, high, narrow, round-headed windows, each ending in a high gable dormer rising out of the roof. It does make one think of ancient buildings in Europe that were built at a very different time. And yet these were built with modern materials. And each of these parts of the building expresses and says something very important about what its function had been. Altogether then, this building functions beautifully as a focal point for the seminary campus, and indeed a major landmark for this section of Lancaster as a whole. Now let me go back again to another thought, another quote regarding the philosophy and the thinking and theology behind those who helped to develop the seminary. To quote again, "Each stage in this organic development that I mentioned before tends to produce its own way of expressing the Christian faith according to the given historical circumstances. The founders look forward to a new and higher stage of Christianity, a new and higher stage in which Protestantism and Catholicism would be reconciled to form an evangelical Catholic Church." And I can't resist adding this sentence because I've read it and it's so telling. This, Schaff believed, by the way, he predicted it would occur in the 19th century and among the American people. Now, of course, each of us will have to think if that's happened or not. Now, another word or two about the conversion of this prayer hall to the Santee Chapel we know today. Now, of course, 30 years have passed from 1894 to 1925. But in only 30 years, the architectural profession and aesthetics and architecture and art had changed enormously in that short time. There was a dramatically higher level of sophistication in the American architectural profession. Even as late as the mid-19th century, many architects were still forced to look at books to get their ideas and their precedent for designing their own buildings. But this is no longer true. By the 1920s, there was pretty much a universal embrace of medieval precedents for church building and religious construction, whether Gothic or Romanesque. And there was a rise of a new union of the building arts and crafts that had begun with the late 19th century and is sometimes called the American Renaissance. And when I say that, I mean more than ever before, architects and stained glass studios and wood carvers and stone carvers and mosaic makers and muralists and painters, the whole range of artisans and craftspeople and architects were working together like never before to create unified environments where each part added to the whole, each part made sense and contributed to a larger whole. And therefore, these are just a few examples of how much the scene had changed between 1894 and 1925. Now, who was the person responsible for this new space that we see here now that you've heard described so well by Shelley? His name was Clarence Clark Zantzinger. Appropriately, a German name, spent some time being educated in Germany, and he helped to found a firm that is widely known in Philadelphia area for its very fine designs in houses and churches and institutional buildings, and that firm was Zantzinger, Borey, and Mederi. He was a graduate of the École des Beaux-Arts in 1901, about 40 years after Richardson. There are many fine examples of his work. This seemed to be the most appropriate to emphasize today. This is a chapel for an Episcopal seminary in West Philadelphia. Happens to be about three blocks from where I live. It's known as the Divinity School in my neighborhood, but it's no longer used as a Divinity School. The Episcopal Seminary left, 20, 30 years ago, and now it's owned by the University of Pennsylvania. And the buildings for the campus are used for a variety of purposes. But this was designed by the firm of Zantzinger, Borey, and Mederi. And again, you'll see the use of the medieval, in this case, Gothic precedent, streamlined, however, and reduced to its simplest form, sometimes called streamlined Gothic or Art Deco Gothic, dating from the 1920s. And here's a detail from one of the above one of the doorways. And here is a spectacular view of the stalls that line the walls. And this actually operated as a collegiate chapel originally, where faculty and students would face each other across the central aisle. Fascinating, unusual example of this collegiate chapel design in America. Unfortunately, much of it's been removed and stored for other uses. Now, the medieval style as practiced by Zantzinger and his colleagues was more archaeological, was more true to the original. Richardson was deliberately, back in the 1880s and 70s, was deliberately starting with a style, starting with a look, and manipulating it, making it into something very new. And in fact, he created a new style that was only somewhat related to the original inspiration. But architects by the 19-teens and 20s and 30s were often more faithful to the original precedent, and more archaeological, meaning they knew more about how things looked, and often they wanted to replicate that or reproduce it or be more faithful to it as it once looked. Their concern was with good proportions, with relationships between the parts of a building, good materials, good details, less concern with creating a new style. And therefore, it's fascinating to see how the archaeological Romanesque of the 1920s is added here to the Richardson Romanesque of the 1890s. And in just a moment, after I show you a couple more slides, I think we should bring the lights back up and we'll take a look around us and see those differences. And you just heard about the reredos and the altar and the chancel furnishings and the windows and the icons. But another word about the windows. Shelley did a nice job of saying briefly how the windows here are a world apart from the windows that might have been put in this kind of building 20 years before. This is an example of a window by Lewis Cufford Tiffany. And much like Richardson, he was taking an ancient craft, an ancient art, and was changing it dramatically and creating a new kind of stained glass, a new invention. Tiffany's windows and Lafarge's windows in America in the 1870s and 80s and 90s were a new invention, a new kind of glass, and creating a painting in glass, a realistic painting in glass, a complete departure from medieval precedents. But naturally, as you've heard, it made perfect sense that when Zantzinger was hired to create this chapel, and given the history of the seminary, he looked back to medieval precedents when the Catholic Church was whole before the Reformation, and the windows, therefore, were supplied not by Tiffany, but by Reynolds, Francis, and Ronstock of Boston, one of the leading firms in a medieval or Gothic style. And instead of pastel colors and natural, you know, naturally cut pieces of glass so it looks like a painting, where the leading is kind of minimized and you don't even notice it, you're looking more at the glass. Here, everything is abstract. The jewel-like deep blue and red colors that you'll find in Chartres, for example, and the other great cathedrals of France and England, that's what they're returning to. Everything is abstract and stylized, and often the areas of black and the leading is an integral part of the glass. It's meant to be there, and you're meant to see that. And this is, so unfortunately, since it's so dark, you can't really look at them all yourselves now, but this is one example of the windows here. You've already heard about the iconography of what they have to show us. But the windows really are a very strong evidence of a very different aesthetic that was being used when this chapel was installed in the 1920s. Now, why don't we turn the lights up for a moment, and I'll say a few more words, and then Shelley and I will sit up in front and we'll have a little conversation. Thank you. I thought I might add one more thing, because I really enjoyed walking through this space with Peter Schmeichen and hearing his comments. And he has articulated so beautifully before something that I thought I'd add here as well. This is a complex, richly layered space full of complex forms. It takes a while to see it all. The roof timbers are open. No, there's no plaster there. Nobody's pretending these are stone vaults. It's an open, honest wood roof. You can see the repeated arches in front of you and behind you. The angles, the curves, the geometric forms, the half circle, the square, the rectangle, the triangle. The play of light and shadow, both in daytime and at night. It's even been suggested, and I think this is one of the most interesting ideas, that the ceiling is a kind of heaven supported by hammer beams on these corbels here. And then, of course, the wall ascends into the, breaks the ceiling to surround each of the windows. In effect, if you see the walls and the floor as earth and the ceiling is a kind of heaven, you can see how they intermingle. It's not an easy, there's no quick and easy line here. It's all broken. It's all complex. It's fascinating. You can really stand and look around the space for a very long time and not even see it all. And, of course, I think symbolically that says a lot about the layering and the different sources that were used to create the space. Now, another, I might say another word, by the way. The beautiful carved oak here, the ceiling and the hammer beams, the side paneling. There are many vestiges of the original space when it was a prayer hall. But, as you've heard Shelley say, the altar rail, the altar itself, the new floor, the pews, the window inserts, and this new vestibule, which creates a kind of third space. You have a kind of a gathering space with this arcade defining its edge. You have the worship space where the congregation gathers, and then you have the chancel space. In effect, there is a tripartite, another symbolic division of this room. And in fact, another thing I might add to what Shelley said, there's a lot more symbolism in terms of the numbers that are used, and of course the iconography of the glass. There is so much richness here. But it's interesting, if you look at the way these column capitals are expressed, or if the way the arches are expressed, and then you were to go outside again and look at the Lark Building from the outside, it's a world apart. You can see they're both Romanesque, but one was a modern American Romanesque from the 1890s, and this is a more proper Romanesque from the 1920s, which ironically goes back much farther. Now, one concluding comment before we have a chance to converse. I think it's safe to say that just as the founders of this seminary and those who developed it and founded the Mercersburg movement promulgated a new vision for evangelical Catholicism, as they put it, which reconciled and united the best features of Catholic and Protestant traditions, so this Lark Building, I think, and its chapel represent the joining of a number of important things. Tradition and established genius, you might say, the ancient Romanesque and Gothic traditions of the European Catholic Church before the Reformation, on the one hand, and modernity and the new idiosyncratic genius of American architects and designers, primarily Richardson, but to some extent Zantzinger too. A contrast of romanticism of the 19th century, complex form, uneven profile, rich materials, rich colors, sublime, strong, decorative features, adding to the whole on the one hand, and rationalism on the other, streamlining of detail, the form of the building revealing its function, truth in materials, in architecture and in aesthetics. And some then, you can say, in a way, this is a Protestant form with Catholic enrichment. And another reason I put it that way is because Richardson, for example, designed entirely for the Protestant church. And yet, we can see the layers of enrichment from the Catholic tradition. I think these layers reveal strains coming together in a way that the seminary leaders we've talked about today would have genuinely and deeply appreciated. And I think the result is a monumental landmark work of architecture that tells a lasting story about an influential, truly landmark institution in the development of the American church. Thank you.